I was curious about Mike Winchell, the quarterback of the team we mentioned earlier. He was also a very good baseball player, someone who did not like crowds, I mean, and in some respects a really tortured young man, and we feel for him feeling such enormous pressure upon his young shoulders. I wanted to ask you about something you said about Mike Winchell. That is, this is actually at this point when he was about his incredible play in Little League Baseball. You write, he became the stuff of legend with 27 pitches in a row thrown for strikes, a single season in which he hit 30 home runs. And then somewhere around the time his father started slipping, I should mention that's a health issue that his father had, which ultimately claimed his life, Mike lost that innate confidence in himself. The gift was always there, but he began to question it, doubt it, brood over it. I'm just curious, for a young athlete like Mike Winchell, did he tell you that, or did someone else tell you that, or did you manage to sort of figure that out or ferret that out? Because again, we're talking about young men who might not necessarily be actually all that emotionally demonstrative, or maybe even all that self-reflective. I'm just curious, in an instant like that, how did you come to understand that about this particular young man, Mike Winchell?
Going back, and I'm trying to remember, Mike said some of it. His brother, who I interviewed at length, said a lot of it, and since he was his brother, I felt that was a credible source. And you could see it. I mean, you could see him brood. You could see him shake. You know, you could see him just unable to shake off a bad pass. And the coaches talked about it as well, that Mike had an incredible gift, but could he really, you know, embrace that gift and know how good he was? And so that's why you're there. I mean, I lived there for a year with my family. You know, you can't do this where you parachute in and out every weekend. You have to live there. You have to breathe the team. You have to be there for every practice. You have to breathe the town so that when you go back to Wisconsin to write, you're writing with knowledge and authority, and you can make those statements about someone and know that those statements are correct, because I pride myself on being a thorough journalist. But you can only do that, you know, by immersing yourself in the life and soul and spirit of that team and that town.
He in particular really comes to life for us, and again, I think we, as we read about him, we really feel for him and the weight of responsibility on him. One of the most gifted of the athletes on this team was a young man named Ivory Christian, and one of the things that is especially intriguing about him is his own kind of love-hate relationship with football. And it's an interesting story in the midst of what otherwise is the story of so many people who seem to love nothing in their lives nearly as much as they love football. And this young man, Ivory Christian, he doesn't have that relationship to football really at all.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, and I think one of the reasons this book has endured for 25 years, and I've thought about it a lot, is that it is timeless, and it's timeless because of these characters. I think that we all probably know a Winchell or someone like Winchell or someone like Ivory Christian, who's very ambivalent of the game. One of the chapters is the ambivalence of Ivory. Ivory was very, very proud. He saw the racism in the town. He saw aspects of not racism on the team, but, you know, he was very aware of the fact that there, in a sense, was some segregation on the team in terms of the black players, you know, hanging together. And so I think that bothered him. It bothered him a lot when he was incredibly skilled and did not start at middle linebacker his junior year. The person who took his place as a starter was 136 pounds. I mean, there was no comparison, and that bothered him, and that made him wonder why. And Ivory was very smart and very intuitive and very, very proud. So there were moments, you know, where he would get into the mania of Mojo, which was the moniker, and then moments where he stood back. Because, you know, when you live on the south side of town, you're not really a part of that. You know, you're not really a part of that. Sometimes you get invited to the parties, you know, sometimes you don't, because this very much was a sport that was embraced, you know, by the whites in the town. I mean, you know, the football team was overwhelmingly majority white. And there were six black players who took up, I think, seven starting positions, but they were always, you know, always on the fringe.
Mm.
And Ivory was aware of that.
Mm. Of course, the other black player among the six that you focused on was Boobie Miles. And, of course, his story in some respects is kind of the central tragedy of the story because of the terrible injury which he sustained. And what made it especially tragic, of course, were the circumstances under which this serious knee injury occurred.
Well, Boobie is a tragedy. I've kept up with Boobie since the book. I love Boobie. We've kept up regularly in the new afterword, which is a real afterword. It's about 10,000 words, and I spent time writing it. Boobie is now in prison. I can't say I'm surprised. His life has never, ever been the same. He was one of the best running backs in the state of Texas. His physique was really almost like LeBron in football. He was a man among boys. And he had waited for his senior season all his life, all these expectations. The town has incredible expectations for him. And then I'll never forget it. It was in Jones Stadium in Lubbock, Texas. It was in August. It was just about dusk. And his cleat gets stuck in the turf, and someone hits him, not even that hard, and he tore his anterior cruciate ligament. And that pretty much was it. And then once he got hurt, he got discarded. There were horrible racial epithets said of him. And, you know, there are 1,000 boobies out there who get, you know, thrown by the side of the road when someone is better or when they get hurt. And, you know, it's dangerous for these kids. It's not a good thing. And there are thousands of kids like Boobie who Boobie was basically, you know, treated as, I hate to say this, but it's true, as a football animal, that the only thing he could do in life was play football. That's the only skill he had. So there were no academics. There was no push on him to study. You know, it was not encouraged. They just wanted to make sure he got through and would be eligible to play. And he will be the first to tell you that he really, really suffered because of that.
Hmm.
When you're a 17-year-old kid and you're on top of the world, as a lot of these high school athletes are in this country, when you're on top of the world and people are extolling you and you have, you know, 10 or 15, 1,000. I heard of some kid who plays, I think, for Allen, who had 30,000 followers on Twitter. 30,000 in high school. In high school. When that happens, you're not going to care about grades. You're not going to care about academics. You're waiting for that next football game. Boobie is a junior, got paid to play football. He would go into the locker room every Monday and there would be an envelope containing as many dollars as yards he had gained the previous Friday night. Well, you're not going to care about academics when you're getting, one game he gained 300 yards. $300 to a kid who doesn't have a lot of money, that's a big deal, but it's going to blow your head. It just is. And, you know, he is the end result, and I think if there's anything in Friday Night Lights that lingers, although I think there's a lot that lingers, Boobie is the ultimate cautionary tale of everything that's wrong about our system of sports today.
Hmm. Among the other important athletes whom you examine, one of the most interesting stories is of Don Billingsley, who's one of the real party animals on the team.
Right.
But beneath that surface is a really compelling story about he and his dad. At one point you say when his parents split up and he ultimately made the choice of coming back to live with his dad on a permanent basis. And you write, living with his dad, living with Charlie, was sometimes more like living with an older brother or a roommate than with a father. I mean, so that's the backdrop under which
right.
He is playing out his life the way you describe.
And that, you know, that came from Don, and I met Charlie, and I like Charlie. And I want to add that Charlie was portrayed by Tim McGraw himself. And that portrayal was completely made up, basically. There was very little truth in it. Charlie had been an All-State player from Permian. Charlie was tough as nails. Charlie, you know, had issues, but you're right. I mean, Don wanted to follow in his father's footsteps. They were very big footsteps because everyone in that town remembers the great high school players. And so Don went to live with Charlie and played football. And Don inherited from Charlie. You know, Charlie liked the party, and Don loved the party. He wasn't. He was a rogue. He was a rogue. He was charming. He was funny. He was bright. He liked to drink. You know, I remember him saying once after they lost the game, he said, you know, this is a great opportunity to find a woman who feels sorry for you, maybe take go to bed. I mean, that's how he saw life. But, you know, Don literally got religion after a dear friend of his committed suicide when he was a freshman in college, and that woke him up, and Don has gone on to do really terrific things. Is a healthcare consultant, looks great, still at his playing weight, has three terrific kids, which proves to me that sometimes the worst barometer of future performance is high school. I never would have expected that out of Don. Ever.
Right. Another, in a sense, surprise is, or somebody who very much discards some of the stereotypes that we've been talking about, is this a young man named Brian Chavez, who, unlike most of his teammates, was not only a very good football player, but actually a brilliant scholar as well, ranking towards the very top of his class, although one realizes that's not quite the accomplishment that it might be right in a more rigorous right school district. But nevertheless, you write, he fit every stereotype of the dumb jock, all of which went to show how absolutely meaningless stereotypes can be. He was a remarkable kid from a remarkable family. He would be one of the more feel-good stories in Friday Night Lights.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to feel good about Brian. And once again, he is a character that many people today can identify with your kids who love football. And by the way, I love football. I love football. But Brian saw football the way it should be seen. It's not a means to an end. It's a place to have fun, to get out your aggressions, to be part of what was then a legendary program. But he never saw it as a launching point. He was very, very strong. You know, the way he talks sometimes, if you met him initially, you'd say, well, what's with that kid? He doesn't seem very smart. And then you would get to know him. And then you would know that he was number two in his class. And then you would know that he applied to Harvard. And then you know that he got into Harvard. It was a very difficult transition. But, you know, he made it through, which was really wonderful. I think he was the first person to go to Harvard from Odessa in probably 25 years. But, you know, why did they pick Brian? Because, as I say, I was looking for types that were representative, not just of the team in Odessa, but the team everywhere in the U.S., basically. And as I said, Brian understood and saw football the right way. So what does that mean? If you keep perspective about sports, you get a lot out of it. That the things we always say you learn, but you don't learn because there's so much emphasis on winning, you do learn, particularly if you're academically inclined, which is teamwork, camaraderie, dedication, learning how to win, you know, dreams coming true. And Brian really personified that until, frankly, something happened about 5 years ago that just totally devastated me.
Right. And that's an interesting story, too, from your afterword. Finally, Jared McDougal, someone you felt so close to. And I have to say, there is a photograph of him in the book. I first saw this when the afterword was excerpted in Sports Illustrated, and I saw this photograph, and that was the moment when I thought, I finally have to read Friday Night Lights. Describe to our listeners this extraordinary photograph that I'm talking about and what it says about Jared McDougal.
You know, and I want to say that the pictures were taken by Rob Clark, and they are absolutely brilliant pictures, some of the best pictures I've ever seen, including the iconic cover. And this picture you're describing, Permian had just lost the Midland League. Midland was the sister city. It was a shocking loss. It was an upset. They had lost by a point. And there's a picture afterwards of Jared. His shoulder pads are off. He's just in his gray undershirt. He's sobbing. His eyes are closed. Another player is sobbing into his shoulder, and he punches his fist against the wall. And you're exactly right. You see the agony. You see the sadness. You see the pressure. You see everything in that face. You see a young man who has been absolutely devastated by, you know, a football loss, and you both feel terrible for him. And then you say, whoa, wait a second. Let's get a grip here. Could it possibly be that important? Well, the answer is yes.
In Odessa, Texas, it is.
Right.
That's for sure.